soon after, mad with grief for the child she had lost, and perhaps for the man who had dishonored her at Harrenhall as well. She died never knowing that Sir Barristan had loved her. How could she? He was a knight of the King's Guard, sworn to celibacy. No good could have come from telling her his feelings. No good came from silence either. If I had unhorsed Rhaegar and crowned Ashara queen of love and beauty, might she have looked to me instead of Stark? He would never know. But of all his failures, none haunted Barristan Selmy so much as that. The sky was overcast, the air hot, muggy, oppressive. Yet there was something in it that made his spine tingle. Rain, he thought. A storm is coming. If not tonight, upon the morrow. Sir Barristan wondered if he would live to see it. If Hisdar has his own spider, I am as good as dead. Should it come to that, he meant to die as he had lived, with his long sword in his hand. When the last light had faded in the west, behind the sails of the prowling ships on Slaver's Bay, Sir Barristan went back inside, summoned a pair of serving men, and told them to heat some water for a bath. Sparring with his squires in the afternoon heat had left him feeling soiled and sweaty. The water, when it came, was only lukewarm, but Selmy lingered in the bath until it had grown cold and scrubbed his skin till it was raw. Clean as he had ever been, he rose, dried himself, and clad himself in whites. Stockings, small clothes, silken tunic, padded jerkin, all fresh washed and bleached. Over that he donned the armour that the Queen had given him as a token of her esteem. The mail was gilded, finely wrought, the links as supple as good leather, the plate enamelled, hard as ice and bright as new fallen snow. His dagger went on one hip, his long sword on the other, hung from a white leather belt with golden buckles. Last of all, he took down his long white cloak and fastened it about his shoulders. The helm he left upon its hook. The narrow eye slit limited his vision, and he needed to be able to see for what was to come. The halls of the pyramid were dark at night, and foes could come at you from either side. Besides, though the ornate dragon's wings that adorned the helm were splendid to look upon, they could too easily catch a sword or axe. He would leave them for his next tourney, if the Seven should grant him one. Armed and armoured, the old knight waited, sitting in the gloom of his small chamber adjoining the Queen's apartments. The faces of all the kings that he had served and failed floated before him in the darkness, and the faces of the brothers who had served beside him in the King's Guard as well. He wondered how many of them would have done what he was about to do. Some, surely, but not all. Some would not have hesitated to strike down the shaved pate as a traitor. Outside the pyramid, it began to rain. Sir Barristan sat alone in the dark, listening. It sounds like tears, he thought. It sounds like dead kings weeping. Then it was time to go. The Great Pyramid of Meereen had been built as an echo to the Great Pyramid of Giz, whose colossal ruins Lomas Longstrider had once visited. Like its ancient predecessor, whose red marble halls were now the haunt of bats and spiders, the Meereenese pyramid boasted 33 levels, that number being somehow sacred to the gods of Giz. Sir Barristan began the long descent alone, his white cloak rippling behind him as he started down. He took the servant's steps, not the grand stairways of vein marble, but the narrower, steeper, straighter stairs, hidden within the thick brick walls. 12 levels down, he found the shave pate waiting, his coarse features still hidden by the mask he had worn that morning, the blood bat. 6 brazen beasts were with him. All were masked as insects, identical to one another. Locusts, Selmy realized. Grolio, he said. Grolio, one of the locusts replied.
I have more locusts, if you need them, said Skarhaz.
6 should serve. What are the men on the doors?
Mine. You will have no trouble.
Sebastian clasped the shape fate by the arm. Shed no blood unless you must. Come the morrow we will convene a council and tell the city what we have done and why.
As you say. Good fortune to you, old man.
They went their separate ways. The brazen beasts fell in behind Sir Barristan as he continued his descent. The king's apartments were buried in the very heart of the pyramid, on the 16th and 17th levels. When Selmy reached those floors, he found the doors to the interior of the pyramid chained shut, with a pair of brazen beasts posted as guards. Beneath the hoods of their patchwork cloaks, one was a rat, the other a bull. "Grolio," Sir Barristan said. "Grolio," the bull returned. "Third all to the right." The rat unlocked the chain. Sir Barristan and his escort stepped through into a narrow, torch-lit servants' corridor of red and black brick. Their footsteps echoed on the floors as they strode past two halls and took the third one to the right. Outside the carved hardwood doors to the king's chambers stood Steelskin, a younger pit-fighter not yet regarded as of the first rank. His cheeks and brow were scarred with intricate tattoos in green and black, ancient Valyrian sorcerer's signs that supposedly made his flesh and skin as hard as steel. Similar markings covered his chest and arms, though whether they would actually stop a sword or axe remained to be seen. Even without them, Steelskin looked formidable, a lean and wiry youth who overtopped Sir Barristan by half a foot.
"Who goes there?"
he called out, swinging his long axe sideways to bar their way. When he saw Sir Barristan, with the brass locust behind him, he lowered it again.
"Old sir!"
"If it please the king, I must needs have words with him."
"The hour is late."
"The hour is late, but the need is urgent."
"I can ask."
Steelskin slammed the butt of his long axe against the door to the king's apartments. A slide hole opened. A child's eye appeared. A child's voice called through the door. Steelskin replied. Sir Barristan heard the sound of a heavy bar being drawn back. The door swung open.
"Only you," said Steelskin. "The beasts wait here."
"As you wish." Sir Barristan nodded to the locust. One returned his nod. Alone, Selmy slipped through the door. Dark and windowless, surrounded on all sides by brick walls 8 feet thick, the chambers that the king had made his own were large and luxurious within. Great beams of black oak supported the high ceilings. The floors were covered with silk carpets out of Carth. On the walls were priceless tapestries, ancient and much faded, depicting the glory of the old empire of Gis. The largest of them showed the last survivors of a defeated Valyrian army, passing beneath the yoke and being chained. The archway leading to the royal bedchamber was guarded by a pair of sandalwood lovers, shaped and smoothed and oiled. Sir Barristan found them distasteful, though no doubt they were meant to be arousing.
"The sooner we are gone from this place, the better."
An iron brazier gave the only light. Beside it stood two of the queen's cupbearers, Drakaz and Keza.
"Miklas has gone to wake the king," said Keza. "Maybe bring you wine, sir?"
No, thank you."
"You may sit,"
said Drakaz, indicating a bench.
"I prefer to stand."
He could hear voices drifting through the archway from the bedchamber. One of them was the king's. It was still a good few moments before King Hesdar Zolorek, 14th of that noble name, emerged yawning, knotting the sash that closed his robe. The robe was green satin, richly worked with pearls and silver thread. Under it the king was quite naked. That was good. Naked men felt vulnerable and were less inclined to acts of suicidal heroism. The woman Sir Barristan glimpsed, peering through the archway from behind a gauzy curtain, was naked as well, her breasts and hips only partially concealed by the blowing silk.
"Sir Barristan,"
Hisdar yawned again,
What hour is it? Is there news of my sweet queen?
None, your grace.
Hisdar sighed. Your magnificence, please. Though at this hour, your sleepiness would be more apt.
The king crossed to the sideboard to pour himself a cup of wine, but only a trickle remained in the bottom of the flagon. A flicker of annoyance crossed his face.
Miklas, wine at once.
Yes, your worship.
Take Drakkar's with you. One flagon of Arbor Gold and one of that sweet red. None of your yellow piss, thank you. And the next time I find my flagon dry, I may have to take a switch to those pretty pink cheeks of yours.
The boy went running off, and the king turned back to Selmy.
I dreamed you found Daenerys.
Dreams can lie, your grace.
Your radiance would serve. What brings you to me at this hour, sir? Some trouble in the city?
The city is tranquil.
Is it so?
Hisdar looked confused.
Why have you come?
To ask a question.
Magnificence, are you the harpy?
Hisdar's wine cup slipped through his fingers, bounced off the carpet, rolled.
You come to my bedchamber in the black of night and ask me that. Are you mad?
It was only then that the king seemed to notice that Sir Barristan was wearing his plate and mail.
What? Why? How dare you?
Was the poison your work, magnificence? King Hisdar backed away a step.
The locust, that was the Dornish man. Quentin, the so-called prince. Ask Resnick, if you doubt me.
Have you proof of that? Has Resnick?
No, else I would have had them seized. Perhaps I should do so in any case.
Margaz will wring a confession out of them. I do not doubt. They're all poisonous, these Dornish.
Resnick says they worship snakes.
They eat snakes, said Sir Barristan. It was your pit, your box, your seats, sweet wine and soft cushions, figs and melons and honeyed locusts. You provided all. You urged Her Grace to try the locusts, but never tasted one yourself.
Hot spices do not agree with me. She was my wife, my queen. Why would I want to poison her?
Was, he says. He believes her dead.
Only you can answer that, magnificence. It might be that you wish to put another woman in her place.
Sir Barristan nodded at the girl peering timidly from the bedchamber.
That one, perhaps.
The king looked round wildly.
She's nothing. A bed slave.
He raised his hands. I misspoke. Not a slave. A free woman, trained in pleasure. Even a king has needs. She
is none of your concern, sir. I would never harm Daenerys, never.
You urge the queen to try the locusts. I heard you.
I thought she might enjoy them.
Hisdar retreated another step.
Hot and sweet at once.
Hot and sweet and poisoned. With mine own ears I heard you commanding the men in the pit to kill Drogon, shouting at them. Hisdar licked his lips. The beast devoured Basenna's flesh. Dragons prey on men. It was killing, burning. Burning men who meant harm to your queen. Harpy's sons, as like as not. Your friends.
Not my friends.
You say that. Yet when you told them to stop killing, they obeyed. Why would they do that if you were not one of them? Hisdar shook his head. This time he did not answer.
Tell me true, Sir Barristan said. Did you ever love her?
Even a little?
Or was it just the crown you lusted for?
Lust? You dare speak to me of lust? The king's mouth twisted in anger.
I lusted for the crown, aye, but not half so much as she lusted for her sellsword. Perhaps it was her precious captain who tried to poison her, for putting him aside. And if I had eaten of his locust too, well, so much the better.
Dario is a killer, but not a poisoner. Sir Barristan moved closer to the king.
Are you the harpy?
This time he put his hand on the hilt of his longsword.
Tell me true, and I promise You shall have a swift, clean death.
You presume too much, sir, said Hisdar. I am done with these questions and with you. You are dismissed from my service. Leave Meereen at once, and I will let you live.
If you are not the harpy, give me his name.
Sir Barristan pulled his sword from the scabbard. Its sharp edge caught the light from the brazier, became a line of orange fire. Hisdar broke.
Kras!
He shrieked, stumbling backwards toward his bedchamber. Kras! Kras! Sir Barristan heard a door open somewhere to his left. He turned in time to see Kras emerge from behind a tapestry. He moved slowly, still groggy from sleep, but his weapon of choice was in his hand, a Dothraki Arrak, long and curved, a slasher sword made to deliver deep, slicing cuts from horseback. A murderer's blade against half-naked foes, in the pit or on the battlefield. But here at close quarters, the Arrak's length would tell against it, and Barristan Selmy was clad in plate and mail.
"I am here for Hisdar," the knight said. "Throw down your steel and stand aside, and no harm need come to you."
Kras laughed.
"Old man, I will eat your heart."
The two men were of a height, but Kras was 2 stone heavier and 40 years younger, with pale skin, dead eyes, and a crest of bristly red-black hair that ran from his brow to the base of his neck.
"Then come," said Barristan the Bold.
Kras came. For the first time all day, Selmy felt certain.
"This is what I was made for," he thought. "The dance, the sweet steel song, a sword in my hand and a foe before me."
The pit-fighter was fast, blazing fast, as quick as any man Sir Barristan had ever fought. In those big hands the Arrak became a whistling blur, a steel storm that seemed to come at the old knight from 3 directions at once. Most of the cuts were aimed at his head. Kras was no fool. Without a helm, Selmy was most vulnerable above the neck. He blocked the blows calmly, his long sword meeting each slash and turning it aside. The blades rang and rang again. Sir Barristan retreated. On the edge of his vision, he saw the cupbearers watching with eyes as big and white as chicken eggs. Kras cursed and turned a high cut into a low one, slipping past the old knight's blade for once, only to have his blow scraped uselessly off a white steel greave. Selmy's answering slash found the pit fighter's left shoulder, parting the fine linen to bite the flesh beneath. His yellow tunic began to turn pink, then red.
"Only cowards dress in iron," Kras declared, circling.
No one wore armor in the fighting pits. It was blood the crowds came for, death, dismemberment, and shrieks of agony, the music of the Scarlet Sands.
Sir Barristan turned with him. "This coward is about to kill you, sir."
The man was no knight, but his courage had earned him that much courtesy. Kras did not know how to fight a man in armor. Sir Barristan could see it in his eyes, doubt, confusion, the beginnings of fear. The pit fighter came on again, screaming this time, as if sound could slay his foe where steel could not. The Arrak slashed low, high, low again. Selmy blocked the cuts at his head and let his armor stop the rest, whilst his own blade opened the pit fighter's cheek from ear to mouth, then traced a raw red gash across his chest. Blood welled from Kras's wounds. That only seemed to make him wilder. He seized the brazier with his offhand and flipped it, scattering embers and hot coals at Selmy's feet. Sir Barristan leapt over them. Kras slashed at his arm and caught him, but the Arrak could only chip the hard enamel before it met the steel below.
"In the pit? That would have taken your arm off, old man."
"We are not in the pit. Take off that armor. It is not too late to throw down your steel. Yield."
"Die," spat Kras.
But as he lifted his Arrak, its tip grazed one of the wall hangings and hung. That was all the chance of Barristan required. He slashed open the pit fighter's belly, parried the Arrak as it wrenched free, then finished Kras with a quick thrust of the heart as the pit fighter's entrails came sliding out like a nest of greasy eels. Blood and viscera stained the king's silk carpets. Selmer took a step back. The longsword in his hand was red for half its length. Here and there the carpets had begun to smoulder, where some of the scattered coals had fallen. He could hear poor Kessa sobbing.
"Don't be afraid," the old knight said. "I mean you no harm, child. I want only the king."
He wiped his sword clean on a curtain and stalked into the bedchamber, where he found Hisdar Zolorek, 14th of his noble name, hiding behind a tapestry and whimpering.
"Spare me," he begged. "I do not want to die."
"Few do, yet all men die regardless." Sir Barristan sheathed his sword and pulled Hisdar to his feet.
"Come, I will escort you to a cell."
By now the brazen beasts should have disarmed Steelskin.
"You will be kept a prisoner until the queen returns. If nothing can be proved against you, you will not come to harm. You have my word as a knight."
He took the king's arm and led him from the bedchamber, feeling strangely light-headed, almost drunk.
"I was a king's guard. What am I now?"
Miklas and Drakkas had returned with Hisdar's wine. They stood in the open door, cradling the flagons against their chests and staring wide-eyed at the corpse of Kras. Kessa was still crying, but Yazin had appeared to comfort her. She hugged the younger girl, stroking her hair. Some of the other cupbearers stood behind them, watching.
"Your worship," Miklas said, "the noble Resnak Mo Resnak says to tell you, come at once."
The boy addressed the king as if Sir Barristan were not there, as if there were no dead man sprawled upon the carpet, his life's blood slowly staining the silk red.
"Skarhaz was supposed to take Resnik into custody until we could be certain of his loyalty. Had something gone awry?"
"Come where?" Sir Barristan asked the boy. "Where does the seneschal want his grace to go?"
"Outside."
Miklas seemed to see him for the first time.
"Outside, sir, to the terrace, to see."
"To see what?"
Dragons. The dragons have been loose, sir."
"Seven save us all," the old knight thought.
Tyrion. He dreamed of a cracked stone ceiling and the smells of blood and shit and burnt flesh. The air was full of acrid smoke. Men were groaning and whimpering all around him, and from time to time a scream would pierce the air, thick with pain. When he tried to move, he found that he had fouled his own bedding. The smoke in the air made his eyes water. "Am I crying?" He must not let his father see. He was a Lannister of Castle Rock. A lion? I must be a lion, live a lion, die a lion. He hurt so much, though, too weak to groan. He lay in his own filth and shut his eyes. Nearby, someone was cursing the gods in a heavy, monotonous tone. He listened to the blasphemies and wondered if he was dying. After a time, the room faded. He found himself outside the city, walking through a world without colour. Ravens soared through a grey sky on wide black wings, while carrion crows rose from their feasts in furious clouds wherever he set his steps. White maggots burrowed through black corruption. The wolves were grey, and so were the Silent Sisters. Together they stripped the flesh from the fallen. There were corpses strewn all over the tawny fields. The sun was a hot white penny, shining down upon the grey river as it rushed around the charred bones of sunken ships. From the pyres of the dead rose black columns of smoke and white-hot ashes. "My work," thought Tyrion Lannister. "They died at my command." At first there was no sound in the world, but after a time he began to hear the voices of the dead, soft and terrible. They wept and moaned,
They begged for an end to pain. They cried for help and wanted their mothers. Tyrion had never known his mother. He wanted Shay, but she was not there. He walked alone amidst the grey shadows, trying to remember. The Silent Sisters were stripping the dead men of their armour and clothes. All the bright dyes had leached out from the surcoats of the slain. They were garbed in shades of white and grey, and their blood was black and crusty. He watched their naked bodies lifted by arm and leg to be carried swinging to the pyres to join their fellows. Metal and cloth were thrown in the back of a white wooden wagon pulled by two tall black horses.
So many dead. So very many.
Their corpses hung limply, their faces slack or stiff or swollen with gas, unrecognizable, hardly human. The garments the sisters took from them were decorated with black hearts, grey lions, dead flowers, and pale, ghostly stags. Their armour was all dented and gashed, the chainmail riven, broken, slashed.
Why did I kill them all?
He had known once, but somehow he had forgotten. He would have asked one of the Silent Sisters, but when he tried to speak, he found he had no mouth. Smooth, seamless skin covered his teeth. The discovery terrified him. How could he live without a mouth? He began to run. The city was not far. He would be safe inside the city, away from all these dead. He did not belong with the dead. He had no mouth, but he was still a living man. No, a lion, and alive. But when he reached the city walls, the gates were shut against him. It was dark when he woke again. At first he could see nothing, but after a time the vague outlines of a bed appeared around him. The drapes were drawn, but he could see the shape of curved bedposts and the droop of the velvet canopy over his head. Under him was the yielding softness of a feather bed, and the pillow beneath his head was goose down.
My own bed. I am in my own bed, in my own bedchamber.
It was warm inside the drapes, under the great heap of furs and blankets that covered him. He was sweating.
Fever, he thought groggily.
He felt so weak, and the pain stabbed through him when he struggled to lift his hand. He gave up the effort.
His head felt enormous, as big as the bed, too heavy to raise from the pillow.
His body he could scarcely feel at all.
How did I come here?
He tried to remember. The battle came back in fits and flashes. The fight along the river. The knight who'd offer up his gauntlet. The bridge of ships.
Sir Mandan.
He saw the dead, empty eyes, the reaching hand, the green fire shining against the white enamel plate. Fear swept over him in a cold rush. Beneath the sheets, he could feel his bladder letting go. He would have cried out if he'd had a mouth.
No, that was the dream, he thought, his head pounding. Help me! Someone, help me! Jamie! Shay! Mother! Someone! Tysha!
No one heard. No one came. Alone in the dark, he fell back into piss-scented sleep. He dreamed his sister was standing over his bed with their Lord Father beside her, frowning. It had to be a dream, since Lord Tywin was 1,000 leagues away, fighting Robb Stark in the west. Others came and went as well. Varys looked down on him and sighed, but Littlefinger made a quip.
Bloody, treacherous bastard, Tyrion thought venomously. We sent you to Bitterbridge, and you never came back.
Sometimes he could hear them talking to one another, but he did not understand the words. Their voices buzzed in his ears like wasps muffled in thick felt. He wanted to ask if they'd won the battle.
We must have. Yes, I'd be ahead on a spike somewhere. If I live, we won.
He did not know what pleased him more, the victory or the fact he'd been able to reason it out. His wits were coming back to him, however slowly. That was good. His wits were all he had. The next time he woke, the draperies had been pulled back, and Podrick Payne stood over him with a candle. When he saw Tyrion open his eyes, he ran off.
"No, don't go. Help me. Help!"
He tried to call, but the best he could do was a muffled moan.
"I have no mouth."
He raised a hand to his face, his every movement pained and fumbling. His fingers found stiff cloth where they should have found flesh, lips, teeth.
"Linen."
The lower half of his face was bandaged tightly, a mask of hardened plaster with holes for breathing and feeding. A short while later, Pod reappeared. This time a stranger was with him, a maester chained and robed.
"My lord, you must be still," the man murmured. "You are grievous hurt, and you will do yourself great injury. Are you thirsty?"
He managed an awkward nod. The maester inserted a curved copper funnel through the feeding hole over his mouth and poured a slow trickle down his throat. Tyrion swallowed, scarcely tasting. Too late he realized the liquid was milk of the poppy. By the time the maester removed the funnel from his mouth, he was already spiraling back to sleep. This time, he dreamed he was at a feast, a victory feast, in some great hall. He had a high seat on the dais, and men were lifting their goblets and hailing him as hero. Merillion was there, the singer who journeyed with them through the mountains of the moon. He played his wood harp and sang of the imp's daring deeds. Even his father was smiling with approval. When the song was over, Jaime rose from his place, commanded Tyrion to kneel, and touched him first on one shoulder and then on the other with his golden sword, and he rose up a knight. Shae was waiting to embrace him. She took him by the hand, laughing and teasing, calling him her Giant of Lannister. He woke in darkness to a cold, empty room. The draperies had been drawn again. Something felt wrong, turned around, though he could not have said what. He was alone once more. Pushing back the blankets, he tried to sit, but the pain was too much, and he soon subsided, breathing raggedly. His face was the least part of it. His right side was one huge ache, and a stab of pain went through his chest whenever he lifted his arm. "What's happened to me?" Even the battle seemed half a dream when he tried to think back on it. "I was hurt more badly than I knew. Sir Mandan..." The memory frightened him, but Tyrion made himself hold it, turn it in his head, stare at it hard. "He tried to kill me. No mistake. That part was not a dream. He would have cut me in half if Pod had not..." "Pod? Where's Pod?" Gritting his teeth, he grabbed hold of the bed hangings and yanked. The drapes ripped free of the canopy overhead and tumbled down, half on the rushes and half on him. Even that small effort had dizzied him. The room whirled around him, all bare walls and dark shadows, with a single narrow window. He saw a chest he'd owned, an untidy pile of his clothing, his battered armor. "This is not my bedchamber," he realized. "Not even the Tower of the Hand." Someone had moved him. His shout of anger came out as a muffled moan.
"They have moved me here to die,"
he thought as he gave up the struggle and closed his eyes once more. The room was dank and cold, and he was burning. He dreamed of a better place, a snug little cottage by the sunset sea. The walls were lopsided and cracked, and the floor had been made of packed earth, but it had always been warm there, even when they let the fire go out. "She used to tease me about this," he remembered. "I never thought to feed the fire that had always been a servant's task." "We have no servants," she would remind me, and I would say, "You have me, I'm your servant." And she would say, "A lazy servant, what do they do with lazy servants in Castle Rock, my lord?" And I would tell her, "They kiss them."
That would always make her giggle. They do not neither. They beat them, I bet, she would say. And I would insist. No, they kiss them, just like this. I would show her how. They kiss their fingers first, every one, and they kiss their wrists, yes, and inside their elbows. Then they kiss their funny ears. All our servants have funny ears. Stop laughing. And they kiss their cheeks, and they kiss their noses, with a little bump in them. There, so, like that. And then they kiss their sweet brows, and their hair, and their lips, their mouths, so.
They would kiss for hours and spend whole days doing no more than lolling in bed, listening to the waves, and touching each other. Her body was a wonder to him, and she seemed to find delight in his. Sometimes she would sing to him. I loved a maid as fair as summer, with sunlight in her hair. I love you, Tyrion, she would whisper before they went to sleep at night. I love your lips, I love your voice, and the words you say to me, and how you treat me gentle. I love your face.
My face?
Yes, yes, I love your hands, and how you touch me. Your cock, I love your cock. I love how it feels when it's in me.
It loves you too, my lady.
I love to say your name, Tyrion Lannister. It goes with mine, not the Lannister, t'other part. Tyrion and Tysha, Tysha and Tyrion. Tyrion, my lord Tyrion.
Lies, he thought, all feigned, all for gold. She was a whore, Jamie's whore, Jamie's gift, my lady of the lie.
Her face seemed to fade away, dissolving behind a veil of tears. But even after she was gone, he could still hear the faint, far-off sound of her voice, calling his name. My lord, can you hear me? My lord, Tyrion, my lord. Through a haze of poppied sleep, he saw a soft pink face leaning over him. He was back in the dank room, with the torn bed hangings, and the face was wrong, not hers, too round, with a brown fringe of beard.
"Do you thirst, my lord? I have your milk, your good milk. You must not fight, no, don't try to move, you need your rest."
He had the copper funnel in one damp pink hand and a flask in the other. As the man leaned closer, Tyrion's fingers slid underneath his chain of many metals, grabbed, pulled. The maester dropped the flask, spilling milk of the poppy all over the blanket. Tyrion twisted until he could feel the links digging into the flesh of the man's fat neck.
"No more,"
he croaked, so hoarse he was not certain he had even spoken. But he must have, for the maester choked out a reply.
"On hand, please, my lord. Need your milk and pain. The chain don't on hand, no."
The pink face was beginning to purple when Tyrion let go. The maester reeled back, sucking in air. His reddened throat showed deep white gouges where the links had pressed. His eyes were white too. Tyrion raised a hand to his face and made a ripping motion over the hardened mask, and again and again.
You want the bandages off, is that it?" the maester said at last. "But I'm not to... That would be most unwise, my lord. You are not yet healed. The queen would..."
The mention of his sister made Tyrion growl.
"Are you one of hers, then?"
He pointed a finger at the maester, then coiled his hand into a fist. Crushing, choking, a promise, unless the fool did as he was bid. Thankfully, he understood.
I will do as my lord commands, to be sure, but this is unwise. Your wounds.
Do it!"
Louder that time. Bowing, the man left the room, only to return a few moments later, bearing a long knife with a slender, saw-toothed blade, a basin of water, a pile of soft cloths, and several flasks. By then Tyrion had managed to squirm backward a few inches, so he was half sitting against his pillow. The maester bade him be very still as he slid the tip of the knife in under his chin beneath the mask. "A slip of the blade here, and Sassy would be free of me," he thought. He could feel the blade sawing through the stiffened linen, only inches above his throat. Fortunately, this soft pink man was not one of his sister's braver creatures. After a moment he felt cool air on his cheeks. There was pain as well, but he did his best to ignore it. The maester discarded the bandages, still crusty with potion.
"Be still now. I must wash out the wound."
His touch was gentle, the water warm and soothing. "The wound," Tyrion thought, remembering a sudden flash of bright silver that seemed to pass just below his eyes.
"This is like to sting some," the maester warned as he wet a cloth with wine that smelled of crushed herbs.
It did more than sting. It traced a line of fire all the way across Tyrion's face and twisted the burning poker up his nose. His fingers clawed the bedclothes and he sucked in his breath, but somehow he managed not to scream. The maester was clucking like an old hen.
"It would have been wiser to leave the mask in place until the flesh had knit, my lord. Still, it looks clean. Good, good. When we found you down in that cellar among the dead and dying, your wounds were filthy. One of your ribs was broken. Doubtless you can feel it. The blow of some mace, perhaps, or a fall, it's hard to say. And you took an arrow in the arm, there where it joins the shoulder. It showed signs of mortification, and for a time I feared you might lose the limb. But we treated it with boiling wine and maggots, and now it seems to be healing clean."
"Name!"
Tyrion breathed up at him. "Name!" The maester blinked.
"Why, you are Tyrion Lannister, my lord, a brother to the queen. Do you remember the battle? Sometimes with head wounds."
"Your name!"
His throat was raw, and his tongue had forgotten how to shape the words.
"I am Maester Balibar."
"Balibar," Tyrion repeated. "Bring me looking-glass."
"My lord," the maester said, "I would not counsel. That might be unwise, as it were. Your wound."
"Bring it," he had to say. His mouth was stiff and sore, as if a punch had split his lip. "And drink wine. No puppy." The maester rose, flush-faced, and hurried off. He came back with a flagon of pale amber wine and a small silvered-looking glass in an ornate golden frame. Sitting on the edge of the bed, he poured half a cup of wine and held it to Tyrion's swollen lips. The trickle went down cool, though he could hardly taste it.
"More,"
he said, when the cup was empty. Maester Balibar poured again. By the end of the second cup, Tyrion Lannister felt strong enough to face his face. He turned over the glass and did not know whether he ought to laugh or cry. The gash was long and crooked, starting a hair under his left eye and ending up on the right side of his jaw. 3/4 of his nose was gone, and a chunk of his lip. Someone had sewn the torn flesh together with catgut, and their clumsy stitches were still in place across a seam of raw, red, half-heel flesh.
"Pretty,"
he croaked, flinging the glass aside. He remembered now the bridge of boats, Sir Mandon Moore, a hand, a sword coming at his face. "If I had not pulled back, that cut would have taken off the top of my head." Jamie had always said that Sir Mandon was the most dangerous of the King's Guard, because his dead, empty eyes gave no hint to his intentions. "I should never have trusted any of them." He'd known that Sir Meryn and Sir Boris were his sisters, and Sir Osmond later, but he'd let himself believe that the others were not wholly lost to honour. "Cersei must have paid him to see that I never came back from the battle," Why else? I never did Sir Mandan any harm that I know of. Tyrion touched his face, plucking at the proud flesh with blunt, thick fingers. Another gift from my sweet sister. The maester stood beside the bed like a goose about to take flight.
My lord, there will most like be a scar.
Most like? Check! His snort of laughter turned into a wince of pain. There would be a scar, to be sure. Nor was it likely that his nose would be growing back any time soon. It was not as if his face had ever been fit to look at.
Teach me not to play with axes.
His grin felt tight.
Where are we? What place?
It hurt to talk, but Tyrion had been too long in silence.
Ah, you are in Maegor's Holdfast, my lord. A chamber over the Queen's ballroom. Her Grace wanted you kept close, so she might watch over you herself.
I'll wager she did.
Return me,
Tyrion commanded.
Own bed, own chambers.
Where I will have my own men about me, and my own maester too, if I can find one I can trust.
Your own, my lord, would not be possible. The King's Hand has taken up residence in your former chambers.
I am King's Hand.
He was growing exhausted by the effort of speaking and confused by what he was hearing. Maester Balibar looked distressed.
No, my lord, you were wounded, near death. Your lord father has taken up those duties now. Lord Tywin,
here.
Since the night of the battle, Lord Tywin saved us all. The small folk say it was King Renly's ghost, but wiser men know better. It was your father and Lord Tyrell, with a knight of flowers and Lord Littlefinger. They rode through the ashes and took the usurper Stannis in the rear. It was a great victory, and now Lord Tywin has settled into the Tower of the Hand to help his grace set the realm to rights. Gods be praised.
Gods be praised,
Tyrion repeated hollowly. His bloody father, and bloody Littlefinger, and Renly's ghost?
I want...
Who do I want? He could not tell Pink Balibar to fetch him Shay. Who could he send for? Who could he trust? Varys? Bronn? Sir Jesslyn?
My squire,
he finished.
Pod. Pain.
It was Pod on the bridge of boats. The lad saved my life.
The boy, the odd boy.
Odd boy, Podrick Pain. You go, send him.
As you will, my lord.
Maester Balibar bobbed his head and hurried out. Tyrion could feel the strength seeping out of him as he waited. He wondered how long he had been here, asleep. Cersei would have me sleep forever, but I won't be so obliging. Podrick Payne entered the bedchamber, timid as a mouse.
My lord?
He crept close to the bed. How can a boy so bold in battle be so frightened in a sick room? Tyrion wondered.
I meant to stay by you, but the maester sent me away.
Send him away. Hear me. Talks hard. Need a dream wine. Dream wine, not milk of the puppy. Go to Franken. Franken, not Balibar. Watch him make it. Bring it here.
Pod stole a glance at Tyrion's face, and just as quickly averted his eyes. Well, I cannot blame him for that.
I want,
Tyrion went on,
mine own guard, Bronn. Where's Bronn?
They made him a knight.
Even frowning hurt.
Find him. Bring him.
As you say, my lord, Bronn.
Tyrion seized the lad's wrist.
Sir Mandan.
The boy flinched.
I never meant to...
Dead? You're certain? Dead?
The boy shuffled his feet sheepishly.
Drowned. Good. Say nothing. Of him? Of me? Any of it? Nothing.
By the time his squire had left, the last of Tyrion's strength was gone as well. He lay back and closed his eyes. Perhaps he would dream of Tysha again.
I wonder how she'd like my face now, he thought bitterly.
Daenerys. Wings shadowed her fevered dreams.
You don't want to wake the dragon, do you?
She was walking down a long hall beneath high stone arches. She could not look behind her, must not look behind her. There was a door ahead of her, tiny with distance, but even from afar she saw it was painted red. She walked faster, and her bare feet left bloody footprints on the stone.
You don't want to wake the dragon, do you?
She saw sunlight on the Dothraki Sea, the living plain, rich with smells of earth and death. Wind stirred the grasses, and they rippled like water. Drogo held her in strong arms, and his hand stroked her sex, and opened her, and woke that sweet wetness that was his alone. And the stars smiled down at them, stars in a daylight sky.
Home, she whispered, as he entered her and filled her with his seed.
But suddenly the stars were gone, and across the blue sky swept the great wings, and the world took flame.
Don't want to wake the dragon, do you?
Ser Jorah's face was drawn and sorrowful.
Rhaegar was the last dragon, he told her.
He warmed translucent hands over a glowing brazier where stone eggs smouldered red as coals. One moment he was there, and the next he was fading, his flesh colourless, less substantial than the wind.
The last dragon,
he whispered, thin as a wisp, and was gone. She felt the dark behind her, and the red door seemed farther away than ever.
Don't want to wake the dragon, do you?
Viserys stood before her, screaming.
The dragon does not beg, slut! You do not command the dragon. I am the dragon, and I will be crowned.
The molten gold trickled down his face like wax, burning deep channels in his flesh.
I am the dragon, and I will be crowned, he shrieked,
and his fingers snapped like snakes, biting at her nipples, pinching, twisting, even as his eyes burst and ran like jelly down seared and blackened cheeks.
Don't want to wake the dragon.
The red door was so far ahead of her, and she could feel the icy breath behind, sweeping up on her. If it caught her, she would die a death that was more than death. Howling forever alone in the darkness, she began to run.
Don't want to wake the dragon.
She could feel the heat inside her, a terrible burning in her womb. Her son was tall and proud, with Drogo's copper skin and her own silver-gold hair, violet eyes shaped like almonds. And he smiled for her and began to lift his hand toward hers. But when he opened his mouth, the fire poured out. She saw his heart burning through his chest, and in an instant he was gone, consumed like a moth by a candle, turned to ash. She wept for her child, the promise of a sweet mouth on her breast, but her tears turned to steam as they touched her skin.
Want to wake the dragon?
Ghosts lined the hallway, dressed in the faded raiment of kings. In their hands were swords of pale fire. They had hair of silver and hair of gold and hair of platinum white, and their eyes were opal and amethyst, tourmaline and jade.
Faster, they cried. Faster, faster.
She raced her feet, melting the stone wherever they touched.
Faster,
the ghost cried as one, and she screamed and threw herself forward. A great knife of pain ripped down her back, and she felt her skin tear open, and smelled the stench of burning blood, and saw the shadow of wings.
and Daenerys Targaryen flew. Wake the dragon. The door loomed before her, the red door so close, so close. The hall was a blur around her, the coal receding behind. Another stone was gone, and she flew across the Dothraki Sea, high and higher, the green rippling beneath. And all that lived and breathed fled in terror from the shadow of her wings. She could smell home. She could see it, there, just beyond that door, green fields and great stone houses and arms to keep her warm there. She threw open the door, the dragon, and saw her brother Rhaegar, mounted on a stallion as black as his armor. Fire glimmered red through the narrow eye slit of his helm. "The last dragon," Ser Jorah's voice whispered faintly. "The last. The last." Danny lifted his polished black visor. The face within was her own. After that, for a long time, there was only pain, the fire within her, and the whispering of stars. She woke to the taste of ashes. "No," she moaned. "No, please." Khaleesi, Jiqui hovered over her, a frightened doe. The tent was drenched in shadow, still and close. Flakes of ash drifted upward from a brazier, and Danny followed them with her eyes through the smoke hole above. "Flying," she thought. "I had wings. I was flying." But it was only a dream. "Help me," she whispered, struggling to rise. "Bring me." Her voice was raw as a wound, and she could not think what she wanted. Why did she hurt so much? It was as if her body had been torn to pieces and remade from the scraps. "I want..." "Yes, Khaleesi." Quick as that, Jiqui was gone, bolting from the tent, shouting. Danny needed something, someone, what? It was important, she knew. It was the only thing in the world that mattered. She rolled onto her side and got an elbow under her, fighting the blanket tangled about her legs. It was so hard to move. The world swam dizzily. "I have to..." They found her on the carpet, crawling toward her dragon eggs. Ser Jorah Mormont lifted her in his arms and carried her back to her sleeping silks, while she struggled feebly against him. Over his shoulder she saw her three handmaids, Jogo, with his little wisp of moustache, and the flat, broad face of Mira Mars Dur. "I must," she tried to tell them. "I have to." "Sleep, princess," Ser Jorah said. "No," Danny said. "Please, please." "Yes." He covered her with silk, though she was burning. "Sleep and grow strong again, Khaleesi. Come back to us." And then Mira Mars Dur was there, the Meiji, tipping a cup against her lips. She tasted sour milk and something else, something thick and bitter. Warm liquid ran down her chin. Somehow she swallowed. The tent grew dimmer, and sleep took her again. This time she did not dream. She floated, serene and at peace, on a black sea that knew no shore. After a time, a night, a day, a year, she could not say, she woke again. The tent was dark, its silken walls flapping like wings when the wind gusted outside. This time, Danny did not attempt to rise. "Ire," she called. "Jiqui, Doria." They were there at once. "My throat is dry," she said. "So dry." And they brought her water. It was warm and flat, yet Danny drank it eagerly and sent Jiqui for more. Ire dampened a soft cloth and stroked her brow. "I have been sick," Danny said. The Dothraki girl nodded. "How long?" The cloth was soothing. but Iri seemed so sad it frightened her. "Long," she whispered. When Jikri returned with more water, Miramar's door came with her.